Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Legacy Finance Division meeting to order, and I continue to learn every day. We have animals before the meeting. I was advised not to have them during the meeting or like early in the meeting because that caused chaos. Now I have them before the meeting. That's not working either. So I'm as a new chair, I'm learning the how to manage my new role and my continue to fail, I think. But
you're doing fine, Mr. Chair.
We're trying. At least I didn't get you up at 6:40 this morning. We had an amazing tour this morning, the new soccer stadium. Thank you for that, Chair Murphy. But today we have with us is the Minnesota Historical Society, and they've been one of the key partners in the Legacy Amendment since day one. And I thank you for coming. The other day we had the 10th anniversary, and I know some of you were able to make it up there, up at the, you hosted it at the center there, and it was just beautiful. They have a marvelous window that opens up to the Capitol, and it was just fantastic. But we had the 10th anniversary. We got a little plaque here, and we have some pins. If you didn't get one already, we'd like to hand them out to members, and if there's some extras, we'd like to give them to staff and as well. So, again, thank you for the History Center for hosting the 10th anniversary. There was about 400 or 500 people there, and it was a wonderful event. And again, you've been great partners since the beginning. But we have with us today Director Whitworth. And you're newer in your role, but you've definitely hit the ground running. And go ahead with your presentation and just tell us about your Great. Introduce yourself and go ahead and tell
Thank
us
Thank you, Chairman Lilly. My name is Kent Whitworth. It's my privilege to serve as the Director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. To my left is a gentleman who needs no introduction, but it's always great to have David Kelleher with us. He is the Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Historical Society. I'd also like to recognize a couple members of our leadership team. To my right, Melanie Adams is our Deputy Director for Learning Initiatives, and Jennifer Jones is our Deputy Director of Preservation and Outreach. So we are delighted to have them with us. We've got a couple of other folks who will be testifying along with us, but I'm going to turn to David and have him introduce them.
Welcome, Mr. Kelleher, and go ahead when you're ready.
Members of the committee, for the record, I'm David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society. As Kent said, later on in the hearing, we'll hear from a couple other individuals. Herman Fechtman, who is on the board of directors of Thompson Hall in St. Paul, which is a community center for the deaf community. Laura Lepping is a former crew member of the Northern Bedrock Historic Preservation Corps, and she'll talk about her experience as a Corps member. And finally, Wing Young Huey, who I think is well known in Minnesota as a very gifted photographer and communicator and storyteller, will tell us a little bit about his work working with projects with legacy funds. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, David. I hope that if you haven't seen that, you will take a look at the latest report, Minnesota History, Building a Legacy. I think it's in your materials that are provided. I would like to just comment, as Chairman Lilly mentioned, I am new to my role. I've been in it about 7 months, but I've been a great admirer of the Legacy program from afar, as have many of our colleagues across the public history profession. Frankly, I am inspired by the fact that 10 years ago, Minnesotans voted to commit tax dollars to bettering our state for the future, and that very specifically included preserving our historical and cultural heritage. I find that inspiring. I'm also very proud of the fact that MNHS has been able to oversee what has really been a palpable surge of communities engaging with their local history in new ways. And the catalyst in many respects for this surge of engagement is the Legacy Program. I am pleased to remind you of the coalition, the Minnesota History Coalition. We have representatives of a couple of the different organizations listed there. I won't read through that list, but you can see it's an impressive group. I would argue, though, that one of the positive byproducts of the legacy amendment is the stronger, more collaborative relationship among Minnesota's historical organizations and other organizations that find themselves wanting to preserve and share their history. So I think that byproduct is significant. I'll ask David to talk a little bit about the structure for history that grew out of the legacy amendment.
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, after the legacy amendment passed in 2008, we had a bit of a blank slate. So the history community got together in a series of town hall meetings around the state to dream and figure out what we wanted to do. Some of the organizations that you saw on the previous slide had extensive conversations to plan for the future about the past. What that group came up with was a few ideas that really became the structure for legacy amendment appropriations for the history area, and this is presented in an org chart form. Really, the three largest areas are a grants program, activities done by the Minnesota Historical Society, and a partnership category, so that organizations would work together to share resources, both financial and intellectual resources and collections and things like that. And we'll take a minute to describe some of the highlights of each of those areas, as well as the Archaeological and Historical Site Survey and the Minnesota Digital Library. But there's a lot going on in the history field, and hopefully this will give you some way to organize what is happening, and certainly a lot of the contact that you have with history legacy programs is through the grants program. The grants for the past calendar year are listed in your report. Every grant for the past year is listed with a short capsule description of those. The other thing that is captured on this chart is the language that's in the constitutional amendment that says to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. We use that as a guideline for how we do our work in planning our projects, as well as the appropriation language that you write into the bills each year, as well as the legislative guide that we participated in the creation of that in the first series of legacy hearings and working sessions that Chair Murphy chaired. I copied that along. So that's part of the base of knowledge that goes into how we administer these programs and think about the future of history legacy projects. The first one, and again, probably the largest, is the grants program. And this is a competitive grant program. It's a statewide program. We have had grants going into all 87 counties, 2,500 grants in all over the life of the legacy amendment. We have a citizen review committee, the Historic Resources Advisory Committee. That's a group of volunteers that come and screen the applications for grants. They are dedicated. All of this work is done online, so they read all the applications ahead of time and spend a day and a half to 2 days reviewing grant applications and making recommendations to our board on which ones should receive funding. Though that process is used for large grants, which is defined as over $10,000, the smaller grants are done on a revolving basis, done with staff reviews, but also with a final approval by our board, which takes a look at those. The HRAC, the Historic Resources Advisory Committee, has a diversity of membership representing the various disciplines in the history field so that we have experts who are reviewing those applications, and we say here that they volunteered 429 hours just last year in doing their work on this online application system. This map that's on the screen is in your report on page 12 of the report, and you can see the number of grants that have gone into each county and the dollar value of those grants. The demand for these grants has been quite high. Usually there are twice as many requests as there are dollars available for those grants.
Mr. Wentworth.
Thank you, Chair. Lily
Wentworth.
As we talk about statewide history programs, that really grows right out of the mission and the vision of the Minnesota Historic Society. And so that's what you see before you. The using the power of history to transform lives is really the vision statement. And then the nuts and bolts of our work around which our mission is fulfilled are preserving, sharing, and connecting. But I want you to pay close attention to the words in that vision statement, words like power and transformation. These are big concepts, and I'm proud to be a part of an organization that diligently works to fulfill that mission every day. So let's take a quick look at how these statewide history programs help preserve Minnesota history, and you see several highlights there. Let me just provide just a little bit of context on the digitization of Minnesota's newspapers. From July 2017 through September of 2018, we were able to digitize 544,558 newspaper pages. This is very intensive work, and there's much, much more to do. But the beauty of the digitization is not only do we preserve, but then we're able to make these materials accessible. And Chairman Lilly, we've talked to you about that in your office in a recent visit. You see that we preserve through oral history projects. Right now there's a major initiative focusing on the Vietnam era. We also are involved in cataloging important archaeological collections. A focus of that work right now is items excavated from the Lower Sioux Agency Historic Site. As we move on to sharing, which is another sort of anchor term in our mission, I wanted to highlight just a couple of our exhibitions. If you were at the 10th anniversary celebration the other night, you probably didn't have time to get into the exhibits, but you would have had the opportunity, had time permitted, to see a new Somali history exhibit that opened in June and will be up for a year. We've been working on that for a couple of years, and there are lasting relationships between us and the Somali Museum of Minnesota growing out of this project. The Legacy Project in this last cycle enabled us at MNHS to develop six different exhibit projects across our network of historic sites and museums. Wrapping up the statewide history program, thinking about connecting. You see everything there from curriculum development to field trip supports to diversity outreach. Again, let me just provide just some context around a couple of those bullet points. In 2017-18, the Field Trip Support Fund helped us provide a field trip experience to almost 21,500 students from 258 schools. And the way we determine that, if you're a school that's got 25% or more free and reduced lunch, then you would be eligible to access those field trip funds. So we're providing these experiences to students in many cases that wouldn't have it otherwise. When we talk about diversity and outreach, just to give a few highlights, we've just launched a new community engagement initiative with the African American community, and this is one of the key points in this diversity outreach effort. It continues to support our Native American initiatives as well. We could talk further, but I know time is limited, and we really want you to hear more about our history partnerships and the archaeological work, and maybe most importantly, hear from a couple of our colleagues that will testify about the direct impact of this work.
Mr. Chair, as Kent mentioned, the next category is history partnerships, and this is appropriation that supports history organizations or non-history organizations working on history projects together. And there are just listed here some of the partner organizations that have been part of these partnerships. The statewide survey of historical and archaeological sites provides funding for some of that baseline research so that we can understand what's out there. There's been a lot of archaeological work done over the years, but sometimes what's needed is to pull that information all together and do a survey of a geographical area or a topic We work closely with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, the state archaeologists, to plan the projects that will be funded through this project. And then the Minnesota Digital Library is a partnership with the Minnesota Historical Society, Minitex, and a number of other partners that helps local history organizations put their collections online so that they will be available statewide and beyond for people to access and enjoy. Mr. Chair, looking forward to this year, Kent referenced the Minnesota History Coalition, the group of history organizations that have come together to make a recommendation to you, the legislature, on what should happen next in the history legacy area. Our goal over time has been to receive a third of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. We're not quite there yet, but these numbers on this slide represent one-third of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and are broken down in the categories that we've just gone through. So we appreciate the support that, you all have provided in the past, previous committees and committee chairs, and we really, really look forward to the future. Mr. Chair, I know that this committee really, really likes animals, and we thought for a long time about whether we should go there in that route, and we thought, you know, we've got the Oliver Kelly Farm, we've got a team of oxen, the lambs aren't born yet this spring, but we've got chickens, and we thought about bringing them. Then we thought the Forest History Center up in Grand Rapids has a team of working horses. We thought about bringing them down. They might not fit through the door. They might really cover a lot of space. And then, Mr. Chair, we also have, I guess you might call deceased animals at the Snake River Fur Post, where they caught beaver that was part of the beaver felt trade that went to Europe for centuries, and we have lots of those items in our collection. But we did think that it's more important to have people who have done this work and participated in this these various programs.
We care about people too.
Glad you do. Mr. Chair, at this point, if we can have our other testifiers come forward, and if there are
before,
any questions.
We just have a couple questions. I just want to, as we transition into that, and so Representative Green, did you have a?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at your requests in the back. $1.5 million for statewide survey historical and archaeological sites. Can you tell me how many sites there are in Minnesota and what the survey is going to entail?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I cannot tell you the number of sites. There are literally thousands of archaeological sites, and what's important is to understand what's out there and have a good base of information. The state archaeologist and our archaeological department do a lot of work on that, but they don't know what they don't know. So when they're working on a specific theme, a couple of years ago, they did a survey of dams across the state to understand what we had for historic dams, to just understand that. They sometimes will do a geographical area and do a survey. And a survey does not mean doing digs. It means doing a search of what information is out there. So the Minnesota Historical Society, the Office of the State Archaeologist, and the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council have an oversight board to determine which projects will get funded for each year. There usually are about a half a dozen projects. This is a biennial figure, and that's our goal for that project.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you have the projects for the $1.5 million picked out already, and I'd like a list of what you consider historical or archaeological site, because it sounds like you're talking about, well, dams and culverts and whatever else is out there. So if I could get a list of what you're considering as a site.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keller, we don't have a list of future projects yet, and we will put together a list, but what I can get for you is a list of past projects that we've done with that. And again, it covers geographical areas, themes of things that we need to know more about. So we'll get you some more information about previous projects.
Looks like Mr. Whitworth has something as well, so go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Lilly. Representative Green, if you take a look at the report on page 49 and 50, there is actually a list on page 50 of the projects, the archaeological projects that were funded during the last cycle, and then page 49 has an overview of that particular work. So that may be helpful, and we're more than willing to provide additional information.
Representative Green. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this may help out Representative Green just a little bit. I happen to live on an archaeological site, and it's an ancient campground, a point that goes into a lake. And a year ago, the state archaeologist did come out and view my site, first time that they'd been there since they declared it a site in 1940, and expressed an interest in doing some more excavation and examining the site. So bring your shovel, Representative Green, and you're welcome.
I'll be there. Under supervision of archaeologists.
So, Mr. Kelleher and Mr. Whitworth, so we'll go ahead. I just wanted to ask you a quick question here, too, before you get going on. So I, when we were up at the part of my speech as the chair of this committee, I talked about kind of where we're at and some of the past with under the leadership of Chair Murphy and Chair Erdahl and others. But anyways, I did make a mistake, as I mentioned, the 1984 exhibit, which was not 1884, it was 1968, but apparently that was a book, right? No, I actually read the book quite a few times, 1984, but 1968. But that had a legacy logo when I toured the exhibit. So can you tell me what that meant and, like, how the legacy contributed to that and what that...
The exhibit that was experienced, thank you, Chairman, that was presented at the Minnesota History Center, I think was in part funded by the legacy amendment. There was another component that traveled around the country that was not funded by the legacy amendment. Yeah. And as we said earlier, a number of the exhibitions that we've presented, not only at the History Center, but across the network of our 26 sites, have been funded, at least in part, by legacy dollars.
Did the recent exhibit that was up there as well with our Among Neighbors, was that in part funded by legacy dollars, or do we have a piece of that? Either of you? I don't know.
Mr. Keller. Yes, absolutely. Thanks for mentioning that. The exhibit that was a couple years ago at the History Center in St. Paul, We Are Hmong Minnesota, was partly funded by legacy funds. And that was a great success, and I'll never forget opening day when I think 3,000 community members came and were very, very proud to be represented in the History Center.
Was there any pictures of Representative Zhang there that day?
He was there that day.
Mr. Keller, go ahead now with your the other folks. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, first up will be Herman Peckman.
Please state your name and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
My name is Herman Peckman. I'll go ahead and proceed.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee and the executive director. I've been the president of the Board of Trustees for Thompson Hall Memorial Hall. Just want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to provide testimony today. I want to describe the important role that the Legacy Fund plays for the deaf community. In 1916, Margaret Brooks Thompson donated Charles Thompson Memorial Hall so that the deaf community would have a free space to gather. The building is located on Marshall and Fairview, and that's in St. Paul. Margaret and Charles are both deaf, and they met at the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf. That site, Thompson Hall, is the first deaf club in the United States. The building was designed by an architect, Olaf Hansen, widely regarded as the nation's first deaf architect and a close friend of his former classmate, Charles Thompson. His design techniques accounted for the good natural lighting, the sight lines to enhance communication through visual sign language. The building continues to serve as a social hub for the deaf people in the Twin Cities, and has played an important role in the growth of Minnesota's vibrant deaf community. Minnesota is home to a dozen of deaf-supported organizations, social groups, and is regarded among the nation's most inviting places for deaf people. We celebrate, we grieve, we plan, we learn, we organize in that historical site. The building's age is in need of repair. It's not a handicap accessible. There's no elevator. The trustees and the deaf community want to actually preserve the architectural significance as a gem, as a valued treasure. In 2011, we applied for the legacy grant so we could hire an expert to develop and figure and apply for the Natural Historical Registry. With the Minnesota Historical Society's help, they helped us through the process, and it really did work. We got the grant and to be registered. Most recently, the Board of Trustees applied and received a small grant of $10,000 from the Minnesota Historical Society. And the reason why we did this is to hire an architectural firm to help us figure out the historical structure, things that we need to repair, how to repair them, and follow their recommendations. Mm-hmm. And that report will be actually done at the end of this month. So now, the deaf community has been working to fundraise, to pay for the blueprints and some of the construction of the addition that we'll be doing. We're hoping to apply for future grants and to be considered for the legacy grant to upgrade, you know, Thompson Hall's plumbing, electrical work, the heating system, and also we'd like to provide accessibility to, you know, like a ramp, you know, an elevator, accessible bathrooms. We want to share the story of Thompson Hall itself, the architectural and the cultural aspects with the public. It's part of Minnesota's history. We want to preserve Thompson Hall, and it's not replaceable. It's a living history resource for future generations to enjoy. I would like you to invite you to come and see Thompson Hall. I hope you do so. Thank you very much for your time, and especially in the role that you play in helping small organizations, volunteer organizations like ours. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good job. And Mr. Kelleher, how are we doing? Oh, we're fine. Okay. Yeah, please come. Sorry. Please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready.
Hello. My name is Laura Lepping. I'm an alumna of Northern Bedrock Historic Preservation Corps. which is an AmeriCorps organization based in Duluth, which seeks to develop enduring workforce and life skills through service learning and historic preservation and community stewardship. The organization also seeks to meet two converging needs in Minnesota, which are our aging stock of historic structures and to develop a workforce of skilled tradespeople, which is also in demand in the state. I found my way to this organization after completing my undergraduate degree, still very unsure about what I was going to do. And as chance would have it, I saw a listing for Northern Bedrock seeking Corps members for a six-month term of service. At the time, I didn't know what to expect, yet those 6 months ended up being pivotal in finding my passion for trades and historic preservation. I was introduced to many hands-on preservation skills, like restoring log buildings, reshingling historic schoolhouses, and teaching people about how to preserve our cemeteries in Minnesota. Yet, I not only gained a comprehensive introduction to trades work, I also learned about Minnesota heritage and grew to love the range of people and cultures across our state. After I completed my term of service, these skills and training I directly received from Northern Bedrock enabled me to apply to positions out west, and I ended up doing internships at Point Reyes National Seashore and the Western Center for Historic Preservation. These positions relied and expanded on the training experience I gained with Northern Bedrock and deepened my interest and dedication to heritage studies and historic preservation. After spending time outside Minnesota, I ultimately found my way back due to my love for Minnesota heritage, history, and people, which is fostered during my time with Northern Bedrock. I didn't know the great impact Northern Bedrock would have on my career and interests, but I am ever grateful for my time as an AmeriCorps member. It was due to these 6 months that I found my passion and am now pursuing a master's degree in heritage studies and public history at the University of Minnesota. And I hope to continue to work to preserve our heritages and historic structures across Minnesota. And I hope to inspire other young people to follow this path and to be excited about heritages in our state and to continue to do historic preservation trades work. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lipping. Nice job. Welcome, and please state your name for the record, and thank you for coming today. And go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you. Wing Young Huey, the Minnesota Historical Society Press published my book, Chineseness, The Meanings of Identity and the Nature of Belonging, and created an exhibit. I am a native Minnesotan and the only one in my family not born in China. I was conceived and bred in Duluth. For most of my schooling, I was the only Asian student in the entire school. When I was growing up, people would ask me, where are you from? I would say, I'm from Duluth. And then they go, no, where are you really from? I would say, I really am from Duluth. If you get that question a lot, what people are really saying is, you're not one of us. Who gets to define who we are? I went to China for the first time 8 years ago and was confronted by my Americanness. So I started thinking, how does my Chineseness collide with my Americanness and my Minnesotaness? So I photographed people in China, throughout Minnesota, other parts of the United States, and got their stories about how they think about identity through the prism of Chineseness. I'll read you a message I just got on Facebook. Someone I didn't know. I don't know. I happened to walk past your book on display at the New Brighton Library, and the title caught my eye. Seeing it was written by an Asian in Minnesota, I became curious. I'm so glad I checked it out. I just finished it and wanted to write you and thank you for writing this book. I'm not Chinese, but I related so much to this book. It was comforting to me knowing there are others who feel as I do and face similar situations. I am Korean, born in Seoul, South Korea, 1984, adopted into a white family. I grew up in Forest Lake, which is predominantly white. I was always too Asian to the white kids, but they accepted me, sorta. I dealt with racial problems all those years and craved diversity, so I transferred schools in 10th grade to Richfield High School and became friends with some Asian people for the first time in my life. Previously, I had no idea there were so many in Minnesota. Most of my friends were Southeast Asian. They accepted me as well, sort of. But I was always too white for them. I ended up dating Asian boys, but their parents never accepted me because I didn't speak Korean and my parents were white. I now have two daughters who are half Laotian. I felt compelled to write to you because it was the first time I've read a book where I related so much to the author and the people you've interviewed. I've always had my Asianness questioned by whites and especially by judgmental Asians. I've not been back to Korea, but will return one day. I first need to get over the fear of being judged by Koreans for not being Korean enough. I have, however, met my birth mother, who now lives in Arkansas. She ended up with half-white kids of her own who have all married and had children with white people. One day, the Koreanness of our blood will be non-existent, even before I've been able to explore, understand, and embrace it. Reading this book has encouraged me to study my culture more so I could share it with my daughters. It also showed me it is okay to have a different level of Asianness than others, and essentially we are all just Americans. So thank you, Wing, for writing this book, which I'm sure was a labor of love. It has made me feel more connected to people that the world has deemed a whitewashed Asian, and now I don't feel so alone and ashamed of not being Korean enough. Thank you again for your bravery and vulnerability in writing this book. It has truly touched me.
Thank you very much for telling your story and coming down to St. Paul today. And we have quite a few Duluth visitors today here. Mr. Kelleher, do you want to wrap up? We did take a survey, and I understand you have an opening at Split Rock Lighthouse for, and we, as a committee, we decided that Representative Erdahl would be well placed there for an extended period of time.
Mr. Chair, our longtime site manager Lee Radzak at Split Rock Lighthouse is retiring this spring, and we will miss him dearly. But I think that there'll be some fierce competition for that job. I mean, who wouldn't want to be working every day at a lighthouse on Lake Superior? So, Mr.
Chair, one more question. Representative Wagenius, do you have a question? Oh, I guess not. I misunderstood, but go ahead, Mr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the time. We might have run a little bit over, but I think it's important that you hear from the folks who are doing the work out in the field, and we're happy to answer any questions. We'll hopefully have an opportunity to visit with each of you, and we would love to bring you to some of our sites and some of our partner organization sites if you do some field trips this summer and fall. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. You've been very good stewards of the funds thus far and the first 10 years. And, you know, it's complicated with all the grants that you're doing and those sort of things. Thank you for hosting the 10th anniversary event the other day. And so now we're going to transition into the Como group. And I was just wondering if anybody's had an opportunity to take a peek at the minutes.
I did, Mr. Chair, and I moved the minutes as printed.
Thank you very much. Before us, we have Representative Murphy move the minutes. Any questions to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? We have passed the minutes from our February 6th meeting. And Representative Erdahl, we just... we took a poll, a vote, and you were decided that you might have an opportunity to go up to Split Rock to take over the and to live there. So I hope you enjoy it. And
who's the legislator there?
Good luck with that.
Eklund.
I don't think Representative Eklund. So, thank you very much, Como, for coming today, and thank you for the as a History Center folks. Lee, thank you for coming as well. But Representative Lesh, we have some chaos was caused in the hallways, which is always wonderful. And this, I know we're a very serious, serious place that has a lot of difficult issues before us, but. We've all been blessed by the zoos in our state and the other facilities. And we have, looks like you brought your daughter. Maybe you want to...
This is a monkey from Como.
A monkey. And we have Chloe here. So I Representative Lesh, why don't you go ahead and begin the story here of Como?
I will. Usually when I make a request of her, that's the answer I get to. But I will, in fact, start on Como. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you. I'll be here for the beginning of this, and then the able Como folks will take it away from there because I have a vote back over at the Capitol on Public Safety. But I wanted to remind all of you, and you all know this, I think, those of you sat on this committee and those of you who haven't before, that Como is a jewel of our state. It does an amazing job. My family and I are privileged to live just about a 15-minute walk away from Como, from the zoo and conservatory. So we go there a lot, as you can imagine. And I see a broad cross-section of Minnesotans and people from other parts of the country and the world who come to Como. And they are incredibly impressed that we have this very nice facility with so many opportunities in the middle of the city, with access to public transportation. By the way, that's not her real hair. That's an Elsa braid from Frozen. But I would remind you that my predecessors, and even though Representative Hausman's not a predecessor, she's still here, but she had Como Park before I did. And both she and my predecessor, Tom Ostoff, worked darn hard to make sure that Como will always remain free. It will be accessible to every single person in the state. And normally you'd think public accommodation like that would be bare bones in terms of what they can offer. But that's not the case for Como at all. The programming and the resources and the exhibits that they have there are bar none top-notch, and everyone knows it. That's why their take at the door of donations provides a substantial portion of what they use for operating. So how many other facilities in this state do you think can operate the way that Como does based upon donations? And they do it because they're that good, because the city of St. Paul and Parks has committed to ensuring that Como is a facility that will provide enjoyment for families of whatever income, wherever they come from, and for however long they're in the city. So we're pleased, and you can see based on the presentation we have here today, right, the cookies, the sloth, the penguin, the monkey over there. Say hi, monkey. Yeah, you're going to be in a cage from now on, so mommy and daddy can get a break for a day. But you can see by the presentation that this is how they present for the folks who come to see Como as well too. And they're very. I've been very impressed, and I'm privileged to represent this in my district. So with that, I would introduce. Michelle, are you going to go first, or
yep.
Jackie? Okay, Michelle Ferrer, who's here, is the director of the zoo and can tell you a little bit about our request.
Ms. Ferrer, please go ahead when you're ready, and thank you, Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Thank you. For the record, first, my name is Michelle Ferrer. I'm the director and campus manager at Como Park Zoo and Conservatory, and I just want to acknowledge Chloe, our Hoffman's two-toed sloth, with our senior zookeeper, Allison. If you were able to catch the glimpse of Cupid, the penguin, who was out front as you came in, yes, his name is Cupid, and his birthday is tomorrow. He'll be 28 tomorrow. So those are some of our animal ambassadors who do go to schools. They visit education programs throughout the state of Minnesota as well as those on site. So we're going to say goodbye to Chloe. And then I'm going to introduce Lindsay Rabb, who is behind us here, and we're going to shuffle seats, I think. Lindsay is one of our education coordinators at Como Park Zoo and Conservatory, and she's got two of her colleagues here who are going to do a little show and tell, per se, but I'm going to pass it over to Lindsay. Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr.
Please
Chair.
Please state your name and go ahead when you're ready.
Yep. Sure. My name is Lindsay Rabb. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm here today to speak on behalf of our residency program, which is one of our many legacy-sponsored programs. I have worked at Como for the last 7 years, and I taught the residency program for its first 3 years. I can honestly say that this program is one of the most impactful programs that I have ever been a part of. The residency students spend their entire school day at Como for 5 days.
After spending that much time there, while getting to know Como's animals, gardens, and staff, many of the students begin to feel a deep connection to Como. Residency students have been known to come back to Como after their week-long program with their families to give them a tour. The students can take so much pride in sharing what they have learned, remembering some of our animals' names, such as our polar bears, or remembering just where their classroom was. The residency program is offered to second and third grade classes in Minnesota, both in the Twin Cities metro area and greater Minnesota. Because of legacy funding this program, including transportation, 3,930 students have been impacted by this program over the past 5 years. This program empowers young learners to imagine themselves working in the fields of science and engineering in their futures. After the first day of this program, we refer to the students as scientists, and that's because they are. They are using the learning, or excuse me, they're using the scientific method to learn about the animals and plants at Como. The students create a special enrichment for both a primate species and a tundra animal throughout their week. The keepers place the enrichment while the students are observing, and this is often a highlight for the students. Whether they created mobiles for monkeys or a fruit salad for polar bears, it is quite a memorable experience for them. The residency program curriculum focuses on two biomes, the tropical rainforest and the Arctic tundra. Students participate in engineering activities such as build a tree and build a house. They also get to go on a tour behind the scenes of the conservatory. They get to meet a zookeeper and compete in the Tundra Olympics. We engage the students with using hands-on, inquiry-based learning activities. Some examples are going around the room, such as our BioFact cart, and one of our hands-on activities, the Blubber Glove, that Emma Singer and Bridget Murphy have. Emma is currently teaching residency this year, and check out the Blubber Glove. It's a fun activity that we use to engage students. This program is now in its fifth year. Over time, we have built relationships with many teachers, principals, students, and chaperones. After going through such a high-impact program, teachers and students feel like Como is a place where they belong. This program helps teachers think outside the box and get their students out of the classroom and into a place for experiential learning. Teachers often tell us how this program is not just a five-day program. This program drives learning and enhances their curriculum throughout their entire school year. Over the past 5 years, I have seen this program grow. In 2014, the first year, we had 16 classes apply. This year, we had 140 classes apply. The growing interest is a testament to the impact that this program has on young people. Many of these people that we are empowering today may very well be future scientists and engineers. Thank you.
Thank you. Good job. People seem to be enjoying the blubber and other things. So,
Mr. Chair, before we had legacy dollars, this program did not exist. This was completely funded through the Legacy Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund 5 years ago, as Lindsay mentioned, and would not be possible without these dollars. And I wanted to kind of highlight one of our programs, and I will do a overview of all of our programs. And what has also happened is our nonprofit partner, which you'll be meeting later with Como Friends, has been able to leverage those dollars with those transportation bus costs. And now we are providing field trips to every second grade field trip class in St. Paul, the opportunity, since the bus is waiting, to bring the groups from all over the state back to their schools. As they were just parked out front, we thought, how could we leverage that? So now we're picking up additional students while it's waiting. So if we don't have any questions for Lindsay, we'll just go right into the...
Any questions at this point? Seeing none, go ahead.
Great,
go ahead,
thank
Ms.
you.
Fur. Sorry.
That's okay. There is a treasure in Minnesota's backyard. A world-class natural wonder in the heart of our state. There are very few places like it anywhere. At Como, we see our work as one part love, one part responsibility, but always a joy to share. For more than a century, we've been a fun, conveniently located, budget-friendly alternative, but we are so much more. We are driven by a powerful mission to inspire the public to value the presence of living things. Como Park Zoo and Conservatory is one of the most visited cultural destinations in our state, with over 1.8 million visitors per year, and they come from all over the state of Minnesota. Not only is Como free and attracts a very diverse audience, racially, economically, and geographically, we are also very inclusive and provide access for all. Whether it's creating fun experiences that deepen knowledge and a sense of connection, or making it easy and welcoming for all people to visit, Como is always inviting and always inspiring. This past biennium, we focused on adding some additional inclusivity events and programming for all audiences. Our sensory-friendly days and events are really targeted because we know that we are an energetic, colorful place full of a lot of sensory stimuli, which can be overwhelming for some guests. We have now provided the tools and special entry events and days for those guests. We also have senior strolls, an opportunity to arrive early before the guests come and take advantage of a special theme day as they explore the zoo and conservatory. And now the first Wednesday of every month, we are offering sign language interpreters, and in this year we're going to be adding some additional language days to those events. Como also has a sustainable business model. We are operated by the City of St. Paul, and their general fund supports our operating budget by 41%. And despite not charging an admission fee, our visitors still give at our voluntary donation program, which also represents 17% of our operating budget. But we are still a lean, mean operating machine. It costs us about $4.49 to operate, compared to other cultural attractions that range anywhere between $14 to $47 per visitor. We're also an economic engine. Our annual economic impact is over $162 million per year. And as you can see with some of the work that you saw today, we inspire learning at Como. Over 425,000 students per year from the Upper Midwest are served through a variety of our formal programs that inspire learning with a focus of STEM and our mission. At Como, we invite everyone to share our love for the plants and animals so that together we can protect them, keep them healthy, and help them flourish, those in our care and around the world. At this point, I'm going to introduce Jackie Stika. She is the president of our nonprofit partner, Como Friends, and talk about the partnership the city has with Como Friends.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you very much. Please state your name again and go ahead when you're ready. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jackie Stika, the president of Como Friends, and we're the nonprofit partner of Como Park Zoo and Conservatory. We work to engage the community to support improvements to animal exhibits and gardens, to support expanded education and conservation programs, and to keep Como Park Zoo and Conservatory free of charge 365 days a year for every visitor who would like to visit. Through the incredible generosity of Minnesota families, corporations, and foundations, we've invested over $41 million in the zoo and conservatory in the last decade. And just recently, we secured the final dollars needed for the new seals and sea lions exhibit that is currently under construction at Como Zoo.
Thank you, Jackie. So Como has been a proven successful steward of past legacy dollars, and for a number of initiatives like the residency program that you heard. We have seen firsthand the impact that these and similar programming can have on our ability to reach Minnesotans across the state with the work that we do. For the next biennium, fiscal year 2021, we respectfully request $1.5 million per year to continue these valued programs and increase our reach for even more Minnesotans. I'm going to briefly touch on some of the ways that we have spent the funds in the past biennium, as well as what we can do to expand those. So as you heard about our residency program, we're doing currently 28 weeks, but I think the message here is that of those 28 programs that we're able to offer, we had over 141 applications representing 41 different school districts around the state. We have introduced a couple new programs. Como in the Community is something we launched this past year, and it reaches audiences kindergarten through sixth grade who do not have the ability to get to Como, so we go to them. Our youth engagement programs are for our older students, grades 9th through 12th, who have a desire to become more in the learn more in the conservation field, and we continue to expand our Nature's Engineers program. Now, if you're getting tired of the winter weather and you need to escape, I'm going to offer you a little tip here. head to the Marjorie McNeely Conservatory on Sunday evenings, not only for the fragrance of our winter flower show, but for our Music Under Glass series, which is one of our music and natures. This next week, we are featuring Lydia Liza. Next week, Lucy Michelle and Mardi Gras with the new Riverside Ramblers. In the past year, we have been able to feature 73 different local musicians and to an audience of over 12,000 attendees at either Music Under Glass or our summer program called Reuben in the Garden. We also host Music Mondays all summer long with a strolling brass band. Now, we pride ourselves at having something for everyone. So in addition to the new inclusive public programs that you heard about, every Thursday we host Little Explorers, which is a preschool program free of charge. And in the last biennium, we were able to expand that to a year-round program. Como has used the funding to improve guest experience and interpretive graphics, added interactive elements and expanded encounters in our large cat building. And in June, we'll be completing the first phase of our marine mammal building improvements. Two preservation projects that are underway in our garden improvements. Cleveland Court is the final stage of the four court gardens. That was the Centennial Garden and the Minnesota Garden, if you remember. And these are bringing back some areas that were part of Como Park that were once stood formal gardens in the 1915s and 1920s that have disappeared. We also are improving access and the experience into the culturally significant Charlotte Partridge Ordway Japanese Garden, which will also be open this spring. Last summer, you might have noticed a new special exhibit that we had. This was a national exhibit called Washed Ashore, to Save the Sea. The installation featured 12 large-scale sea sculptures made entirely of marine debris collected from beaches to graphically illustrate the plastic pollution found in our waterways and oceans. The artwork was combined with scientifically-based education signage to teach visitors about water stewardship, responsible consumer habits, and how every action counts to save our waters. The art display introduced us to a whole new audience, and something new to measure is our social media campaigns. But we had one post that was shared over 582 times, just specifically on this exhibit and on the conservation piece. Besides also offering a space for local photographers to exhibit their work, Blooming Butterflies was here for the past three summers, and we are replacing that opening Memorial Day with a new exhibit called Pollinators, All the Buzz, and this will feature live bees as well as things that you can do in your backyard to make it more pollinator friendly. So as I wrap up, I want to just say thank you. As I mentioned earlier, these programs would not exist without the Arts and Cultural Heritage Legacy Funds and your past support. And thank you for letting us come in and share some of the showcase, some of the highlights that we have with our animals and artifacts, and we're open to any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Hausman, I know you've been a superstar with Como. And anyways, Representative Hausman.
I don't have a question, but may I tell a story about what I learned about orangutans? And a few of you have heard this story, but there are enough new people that when I learned how very smart orangutans are, as I was walking through the zoo with a staff member, there is a staff member at Como who is the stud bookkeeper for orangutans, and that's international, right? So she knows all over the world the breeding, tracking of all of the orangutans who are in captivity. And so I was walking through the zoo with her, and I saw that she picked up a candy wrapper on the ground, and I said, well, you probably have to be really careful about that because you wouldn't want that to get in the exhibit, would you? And she said, no. And she said, of course, the orangutans know that she doesn't want them to have the trash. And so they discovered that she would trade a treat for them to get it back. And then the orangutan discovered, well, if I tear this in half, then I get two treats because I'd have two things to trade. And then she discovered she could tear it up into a few more. And then she realized she could get the treat she wanted if she rejected one. You want this? Nope, I don't want that treat. And so she wouldn't give up her trash until she got the treat she wanted. So we discovered that orangutans are brilliant traders.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you very much for coming and bringing Chloe and Cupid. And, you know, you've been, in my mind, I just had an opportunity a couple like last week, I think it was, to get over and with my own family, and we were just walking around, and we got into where the the penguins are in seals, and you actually, up on the screen like these, you had the Legacy logo, so I want to thank you for that and kind of telling this, you know, the story in that sense. It helps us when we go to renew. We're 10 years in, and I think by telling that story, that helps. You know, and just to be personal for a second, my own family's kind of gone through, you know, we had some tough years financially, and Como really was a blessing to us. We weren't really able to, often we went and didn't put money into the bucket or whatever, and we came, and but now we're able to put money in, and, you know, the numbers are bigger than I used to, you know, so, but that's just how it is, and it's just neat to see the diversity, and young and old, racial diversity, just everybody coming, and I would imagine there's many families that are there that were like we were that just couldn't afford it, and so thank you for that. I happen to like zoos, and the conservatory I think has saved my wife's life. It gets us a little mini vacation of mental health, and you know, with the warmth, you know, if we go outside here in this cold weather. But I'm sorry it talks so long, but I definitely have a sweet spot in my heart for Como, and thank you for that. Any other questions related to this? Seeing none, again, thank you very much for coming, and thank you for being good stewards of the money, and thank you. I saw a lot of happy faces out in the hallways there, too, so that was quite nice, and, you know, we have very serious issues that we're dealing with, but it's good to be happy and get outside and enjoy life as well. So thank you very much. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.